In every parish I've ever served in, there have always been people who arrive late at the main Sunday morning service. Looking down the aisle several minutes after the liturgy started, you could see people quietly slipping in through the door and finding a pew somewhere near the back of the church. Usually, by the time the gospel was read, the congregation had grown by several members. The issue of latecomers has been with us right from the beginning. A major tension point in the Gospels is the uneasy relationship between righteous religious people and the recently converted. Jesus was renowned for being a friend of tax gatherers and sinners, so that he could draw them in again into the restored covenant relationship between God and his people. That meant befriending tax gatherers and prostitutes, not because he was what my mother would call an unholier-than-thou parson, but because he had a knack of converting them and of persuading them to come back on side with God and his requirements for good living. But that often made righteous religious people who had kept the rules from the beginning distinctly uneasy. Were these recent converts for real, and had the gold standard of the religious law been somehow diluted and watered down? It was not just the religious establishment who could take offence at these Johnny-come-lately interlopers. Within a few chapters of a gospel's beginning, Jesus is offside with the Pharisees, who become his main opponents. They are the foremost holiness movement of the day, a renewal movement from below, as it were. Their growing power and influence was such that after the destruction of the temple in AD 70, they would seize the high ground of Jewish religious life and completely reorganize it. When we meet a modern-day Jewish rabbi, we are encountering a direct descendant of the Pharisees. I'm going to come back to holiness movements in a few minutes' time. A few years after the death of Jesus, the latecomers issue presents itself in a different form. There are those in the Jesus movement who knew him personally, and those who were closely associated with his core group. But now there are people who are coming on board who never knew him, and who have only ever heard about him through the living oral tradition of his words and deeds. Even more startling, there are people like Saul of Tarsus who claim to have been encountered by the risen Jesus in a powerful religious experience. Can they be allowed to get into the driver's seat? Or should they be contained in a second-tier membership position where they should mind their P's and Q's? A generation on, and the newcomers and latecomers issue has become urgent and difficult. When we hear the Pauline epistles being read out in church, we can become fed up with Paul rabbiting on at great length about circumcision and dietary laws, issues that appear to have no relevance to our everyday lives. But what's being talked about here is whether a new set of outsiders and latecomers should be allowed in to some extent on their own terms and without the need to be a fully credentialed observant Jewish believer. And if they are to be allowed to come on board, will it be with full membership rights, or will they be confined to a second tier kind of membership, a lesser standard of belonging? Well, we know the outcome of that crisis, which is why we're here this morning. I'm saying all this because, of course, of that artful story presented to us in this morning's gospel reading, and what a clever story it is. It enlists our natural sympathy with the casual labourers who worked all day through the heat and burden of the day and who got paid the same as the Johnny-come-lately last-on workers who barely had time to get a sweat up. Our natural sense of justice is outraged along with the first-on guys as they enter into their protest conversation with the landowner. It's all very well for the landowner to present himself as what we'd now call an equal opportunities employer, but we are not impressed with his affirmative action priorities. It's not fair, a voice cries out inside us in sympathy with the first-on guys. A fair day's pay for a fair day's work is a contemporary phrase we might want to bring into that conversation also. The landowner's comeback would of course be, surely I'm free to do what I like with my own money, but that sounds capricious to us. Just at this point, when our sympathies and our natural sense of justice have been aroused on one side of the argument, everything is turned upside down by the punchline. Why be jealous because I am kind? Thus will the last be first and the first last. This is a standard tactic of Jesus and his teaching method. So, as we're invited to recoil from our fear of being shortchanged in the life of the kingdom, we're left wondering what the application of this story is to our here and now life in the church. There's an obvious take-home message, and although I dislike stating the obvious, it's worth briefly touching on it. It's about the importance of welcoming new people when they turn up on Sunday. We don't have to be all over them like a rash, but it's very helpful to connect with them in a low-key way with some degree of emotional warmth. It's been estimated that if newcomers don't form a relational connection with two or three of the regulars within the first 6 months of their initial attendance, then they tend not to stay. And of course, if newcomers who do have gifts and talents to share and want to help in this way, it's important for them to be given the opportunity to do so. We don't want people leaving because they think they've encountered a closed shop leadership circle. But there's a bigger issue at stake here, and it concerns holiness movements. God renews the church through holiness movements. The Spirit of God suddenly and unexpectedly sets in motion certain inspiring individuals and generates new energy and initiatives in the life of the church. Often these holiness movements create confusion and arouse intense opposition at first, but if a church handles them well, they renew the life of that church. Let me give some examples. Methodism is a holiness movement that morphed into a church. When the Wesleys got going with their heartfelt religion, their soul-stirring hymns, and their revivalist open-air preaching, they got lectured by prominent Anglican churchmen about what a terrible thing enthusiasm and religion was. For a generation, the Wesleyan holiness movement remained within the Church of England. But in the end, the C of E couldn't cope with it, and so those enthusiastic evangelicals left and formed the Methodist Church. This was something that needn't have happened if the Anglican Church had handled things better. Anglo-Catholicism is a holiness movement that, by and large, has remained within its parent church. When Keble preached the Assize Sermon in Oxford in 1833, that caused a minor stir, but when the ritualist phase of the movement got going 2 decades later, with its dynamic changes in Anglican worship, all hell broke loose. There were riots, clergymen were locked up, and a lot of litigation took place. But in the end, the Church of England decided to roll with the punches, to tolerate the movement, and to absorb it into its life. This has enabled Anglo-Catholicism to add value to the life of the Anglican Church. Some of its adherents have left to become Roman Catholics, a few have become Eastern Orthodox, but most have stayed on board and made a contribution to the life of their parent church. In the lifetime of most of us, the charismatic movement has posed a similar challenge. We were shocked to see people swaying with upraised arms and tuned with choruses, babbling in tongues, and keeling over as they were slain in the spirit. There were sarcastic remarks about tree people. There was fierce internal conflict in some parishes as the renewal took hold. But by and large, the Anglican Church again decided to roll with the punches, to make room for this holiness movement in its polity, and to absorb it into its life. Some, of course, left to become Pentecostals because they wanted a higher octane religion. But overall, this holiness movement brought a generation into the life of our church who might not have otherwise been there, and it helped to revive the ministry of healing among us. Cynics might argue that this absorbing strategy has been a clever ploy by the leadership of the Anglican Church to defang these holiness movements and to render them domestically harmless. First, we oppose these holiness movements, then we tolerate them, and then we absorb them, taking the more cosmetic aspects of them on board while quietly parking the more challenging aspects of them in a quiet lay-by. It's perfectly true that there are ersatz Anglican Catholic parishes today where they wear vestments and have many of the ceremonial trappings while in reality being liberal Protestant outfits with very woolly beliefs. One North Island parish is at least honest enough to say of itself on its website that it's, quote, a liberal parish in the Catholic tradition. As a true believer in the Anglo-Catholic holiness movement, this kind of liberal Protestant ceremonialism breaks my heart. But perhaps we get a more rounded appreciation of what has happened here by putting a hypothetical counterfactual to ourselves. Suppose the followers of the Oxford movement had marched off the field of battle and followed John Henry Newman en masse into the Roman Catholic Church in the 1840s. What would the Church of England and Anglicanism in general have looked like then? It would, I suspect, have been a much impoverished ecclesial entity. Finally, let me leave you with this thought. Holiness movements always happen unpredictably, spontaneously coming out of nowhere, operating on God's timetable and not ours. He sees something that needs putting right or gingering up in the life of the church and launches a new initiative that no one saw coming. There hasn't been one for a while. We're overdue for a new holiness and renewal movement. I wonder what he will do this time.